The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So thanks for having me. Where I worked close to UCLA, there's a large federal veteran cemetery, and as I would drive up to park, I was always struck by there were often workers there taking care of the grounds, cutting the grass. And then one day there was a lot of work happening, and what I realized they were doing, they were clearing the ground for more grave sites. And I thought today I would reflect on mortality and the poignancy of being alive. And with all Dharma subjects, but especially this, it's good to actually register what arises just in hearing those words, to not exclude that response from mindfulness. Yeah. And when I talk about this subject, I'm of course addressing you, but very much addressing myself in this. Recently I sort of, in my own practice, I find myself very, very comfortable and happy, but it's not always good to be comfortable and happy for too long in the practice, yeah? It's like my teacher calls it getting stuck in a good place, you know? And this is going on for me to some sort of like just taking a step back to see this. And when we get stuck in a good place or a difficult place, this recollection on mortality is of great value. And this is a challenge of a Dharma life, of being human, of knowing that our time is finite, and of finding ways of loving in the midst of letting go. Of the phrase that from Blake, kissing the joy as it flies, right? This is our life, This is what reflections on our own mortality make clear. Now, the Buddha was, the contemplation of death was so central. It's not emphasized as much in the way the suttas are taught now commonly, but it was so central in the Maranasati Sutta, the mindfulness of death, sort of a conversation between the Buddha and some monks about, the wisdom of imagining that one's life would be just today and tomorrow, or just today, or just the stretch between two meals, and eventually gets to just contemplating life as if it was what the time left was that, the time that it takes to swallow a bite of food. And the language, the encouragement is quite strong, that the contemplation of death is of great fruit and great benefit. About, I think, 8 years ago, I was doing the year to live practice. Which how many people are familiar with that? A few, yeah. So there's a book by Stephen Levine where people make the commitment to live as if this were the last year of their life. And it's a kind of progressive schedule of practices, and it's typically done in a group and includes doing things as intense as I wrote my own eulogy, and then, you know, as all of the students in the group did, and then read it to the group. And of course, it's quite vivid, but it still retained the as-if quality, yeah? It was important and moving for me. But I remember talking with my neighbor, who is a friend and a Holocaust survivor, and her almost all of her family was killed at Auschwitz. And I remember telling her about some of the experiences with the Year to Live program, and she was very she was dismissive and angry, you know, and what she said is, okay, you're doing this program, this course or something, but you weren't in those camps. You don't know what that's like. And so that's really stayed with me whenever I reflect on this topic, because right now, as far as I know, I'm not dying, and am healthy and relatively young. And so there's some kind of humility that's required in reflecting on this. Now, even though this is not, I have not suffered great personal loss myself, this subject is close to my heart. It's sort of the specter of mortality is in, you can feel it in sort of in my paternal lineage, the consciousness around this, sensitivity around this, and specifically in my dad, whose mother died when he was young, and he went on into medicine and to sort of master death, and I feel like that's impacted me in strong ways. And a lot of the time when I reflect on my own Dharma practice, it feels like it's dedicated to meeting the challenges of aging, sickness, and death, and losing people dear to me, losing this. Yeah. So it's close, but there's still an as-if quality, yeah. Gil said something I was quite struck by. As we reflect on themes around mortality or impermanence, and this is such a common recurrent theme in Buddhism, but Gil said something that, you know, all this talk about impermanence and instability, uncertainty, mortality, that's not always so helpful, especially for people for whom there's been a real lack of stability, yeah? And so he's, in that talk, encouraged, the cultivation of a sense of real stability and security. We might say safety, cultivating a sense of inner safety. And it's from that platform of inner safety, the sense of the inner life being safe, that these kinds of topics can be not heavy, but actually fruitful and poignant. So this is Sam Harris, who gave a talk at a kind of religious skeptics conference, and he is pretty direct in it. It's hard to get through to at an atheist conference. And anyway, he's made an interesting case that somehow in the kind of modern challenge of a lot of traditional religious notions, the sacred has been thrown out. The baby's been thrown out with the bathwater, in his view. And so this is his attempt actually to direct the minds of people who maybe are not traditionally religious to this, I maybe could say, sacred. It's a little, you can hear, he is quite direct here. Most of us do our best not to think about death, but there's always a part of our minds that this can't go on forever. Part of us always knows that we're just a doctor's visit away or a phone call away from being starkly reminded of the fact of our own mortality or of those closest to us. The one thing people tend to realize at moments like this is that we've wasted a lot of time when life was normal. And it's not just what we did with our time. It's not that we spent too much time working or compulsively checking email. It's that we cared about the wrong things. We regret what we cared about. Our intention was bound up in petty concerns year after year when life was normal. This is a paradox, of course, because we all know this epiphany is coming. Don't you know this is coming? You know this. And yet, if you're like most people, you'll spend most of your time in life tacitly presuming you'll live forever, like watching a bad movie for the fourth time or bickering with your spouse. These things only make sense in light of eternity. When I was doing that year to live practice, there was this kind of progressive deepening of the realization of my own mortality. And it would be like, I would think that I had accepted the finitude of my life. I felt like I accepted it. And then the process kept going, and there was a sense of, no, it actually hadn't saturated the mind. There was still a piece of the mind holding out in that, denial or that as-if mode. And Freud says, this is Freud about 99 years ago, Freud said, our own death is indeed unimaginable. And whenever we make the attempt to imagine it, we can perceive that we really survive as spectators. At bottom, no one believes in their own death. Or to put the same thing another way, in the unconscious, every one of us is convinced of our own immortality. So the Pali tradition, the Buddhist, lots of different Buddhist lineages suggest that approaching this is of a critical component of our practice. This is Larry Rosenberg, who's written a lot on this. We think of life and death as opposites, life as happening now, and death as something that will happen at the end of a long road. There's a certain unconscious arrogance that goes along with this attitude. Death is not waiting for us at the end of the road, it's walking with us the whole time. bringing up this fear and facing it is a great enhancement to our lives. Really facing death enables us to appreciate and make the best use of our life in a whole new way. So this denial creates a burden on the heart. Just that whole mechanism of denial of anything does that. But denial of our own mortality, especially so, creates a burden on the heart. And we raise this issue just in the same way the Buddha raised the First Noble Truth more generally. We raise this issue to actually see the burden on the heart that's created when we refuse it. Their whole, you know, whole kind of body of psychotherapy, whole body of psychotherapy, existential psychotherapy, that maybe overemphasizes this, but there, the starting point there, and actually developed by Yalom, who's a Stanford person, is that the refusal to open the heart to our own mortality is the source of a lot of psychiatric distress. And maybe that's a little too reductionistic, but there are times when it does feel like all fears converge at the fear of death. And that to even have a little bit more space around that, to have a little bit more ease around that, would lead to a life that's very open. So there's a body of research on this, actually, called terror management theory. And This is terror in not in the sense of terrorism, but intense fright. And what this body of research has looked at is what happens to people when mortality is made salient. When you bring people into a laboratory and, you know, ask them to, as I'm asking now, for us to reflect on these themes. What happens to the mind? What happens to the attitudes? What happens to behavior? And it's quite interesting. As animals who can envision our own mortality, we have to find ways of working with this. And what the mind does is in various ways sets up notions of immortality. And so when you make this theme present in people's minds, there are some consistent patterns that people actually get more, there's more prejudice and in-group favoritism, more authoritarian attitudes, more supportive of violence, and reduced collaboration. Yeah. So, but that's not the end of the story. Otherwise, we really shouldn't be talking about this. You know? So, in this kind of framework, we seek literal immortality in the form of notions of heaven and hell or reincarnation, or we seek symbolic forms in the sense of meaning that we're part of a cultural legacy. So I am an American, or I'm a Buddhist, or I'm a, and then fill it in. But we actually, some of the clinging to these kinds of identifications comes out of a way of disavowing the finite uniqueness of our life. This is one of the researchers. People are motivated to maintain faith in their cultural worldviews and to believe that they are valuable persons within their cultural conception of reality. Because of this uniquely human process, which allows human beings to deny death and minimize the terror associated with it, our worldview and self-worth take on great psychological importance. That's a little bit of a novel way of understanding some of our identifications, the identification with self as this. And possibly, if we can reflect on these, the theme of mortality in a wholesome, constructive way, it may we may be able to see through some of those identifications. I'm an American, or whatever it is. So that maybe we could say that's how the heart hardens in the face of these themes. But you know, there are so many ways that the that mortality can soften the heart. This was, and there's research to this effect too, the kind of pro-social effects, the ways that reflecting on mortality can engender love. And of course, this is my intention in raising the issue this morning. So this is Bill Moyers and Pema Chodron in conversation after September 11th. So Moyers says, on almost any day, I would say, maybe on every day in New York, you can experience random acts of kindness. But after 9/11, kindness seemed to be everyone's daily behavior. I saw so much kindness, and then, of course, it didn't take long for it to disappear. So Pema responds, okay, so this is like the big view of what happens with individuals. What we saw in New York, and you see with people who are in those states, that it's a softness, a kindness. It's as people said during those days in New York, it's the only thing that makes sense. And then what happens? The habit comes back. Because basically, the kindness comes out of not being able to escape from groundlessness. And then, when everyone's in the same situation, you're all groundless together, the only thing that makes sense is kindness. I grew up in New York. My parents were, I was out here, but my parents were there on 9/11. And that, for me, that was a realization of some groundlessness. I had always sort of subtly assumed that something or someone was keeping me safe. And I didn't have theistic notions of that, but I just, there was a sense of like, okay, I'm just living my life and I'm being careful with my own heart and mind and behavior, and I'm safe. And there was something about those planes that that eroded that. But the response in that groundlessness really can be open-heartedness. Mary Oliver says, when it's over, I don't want to wonder if I've made of my life something particular and real. I don't want to find myself sighing and frightened or full of argument. I don't want to end up simply having visited the world. Now this is one of the thoughts, this theme is one of the thoughts that turns the mind towards the Dharma. That it's these reflections that actually take us deeper into our own practice and the path. And in the story of the Buddha, this was the original inspiration for practice and for seeking safety amidst the flow of change. And a lot of our meditation practice, a lot of our reflections are about finding ways of being safe amidst the flowing nature of life. A life that's flowing through our fingers. Our fingers are part of that flow. And what kinds of safety are possible in the midst of that, of the changingness of all things? What kind of safety is possible? This is what the Buddha was looking for. So it's said that these reflections are are treasures. Ajahn Lee's, aging, illness, and death are treasures for those who understand them. If they were people, I'd bow down to their feet every day. Yeah. So we're finding ways of keeping the heart open as we let go. And a lot of times it feels like it's a choice to let go or hold on, but we're all being called to let go in a million ways, and death is maybe the greatest way. So for each of us, we can try to look what kind of safety is possible amidst letting go. And some of the value of our meditation practice is opening to the flow of anicca, the flow of impermanence, moment by moment. Yeah. So there's like a big impermanence, which is birth, aging, sickness, death. And then there's the kind of micro level of impermanence where we increasingly surrender to the flow of sensory experience, where we find ways of relating to whatever the object of focus is, to begin to know the flowingness of the breath, of the body, of even visual impressions, to know anicca moment by moment, which means moment by moment letting go. Letting go into impermanence. Letting go into the flow of impermanence. And impermanence has a kind of it has a kind of undertow. Yeah, like when you're standing in the ocean, you can feel sometimes the undertow. And anicca has that kind of undertow also, except it's pulling us into the flow of life. And it takes everything with it. Everything we think we are, everything we think the breath is, everything we think the world is. And in those kinds of insights and experiences, when the head kind of pops up out of that water, there's a real courage, maybe fearlessness, and a sense of safety, of actually taking refuge in anicca. The safety of the mind that is released into the flow of change. When I reflect on my own fear of dying, I don't think this is all of it, but it's for sure a piece of it. It's the fear of the somethingness of the self dying. It's grieving the identity, the self view. It's like we feel like there's something in us. We feel like it's like the Matthew within Matthew that needs to be protected and is killed at death. And so we're sort of like standing guard at the gates of self. We're in a kind of protective mode. But the Buddha says that we've been guarding a phantom our whole life. That we've actually created a kind of ground inside that doesn't exist. And that ground becomes precious and sacred, and we do everything we can to protect it from the insults of the world, from the insults of aging, from the insults of loss. But we're protecting a phantom. And somehow this insight into anatta is helpful in feeling like there's less that dies. We cultivate peace in the heart. There will be times when there's actually no suffering. This is what I think the Buddha was pointing to. That it's like this quiet, subtle rumbling of dukkha, which is like a kind of noisy diesel engine that we've just acclimatized to. But that shuts off sometimes. That can shut off. And in those moments when we feel, when the heart feels very free, it feels like the kind of, there's a dawning of a sense of nothing can be lost. The end of a retreat, a friend of mine said, there was a kind of talking circle at the end, and she's, been practicing for many decades now, and I remember she said at the end, she sort of thanked the teacher and group and said, today's a good day to die. And it's my aspiration for all of my days to be a good day to die. To live in a way that feels like complete. So this is a poem written by monk Nyogen Senzaki, who is one of the first Zen monks in this country, from my understanding. And this is a New Year's poem. It was written on January 1st, 1946. And this was his first New Year's after being released from the internment camps. And he uses the word zendo, which some of you may know, but meditation hall in Zen. Like a snail, I carry my humble zendo with me. It's not as small as it looks, for the boundless sky joins it when I open a window. If one has no idea of limitation, they should enjoy real freedom. A nameless monk may not have the New Year callers to visit him, but the morning sun hangs above the slums. It will be honorable enough to receive the golden light from the east. So let's just sit for a moment. So here we are together, alive, and may our reflections on mortality, may this serve our own hearts, and may our efforts be of benefit for those we encounter. May we know the goodness of the open heart and find safety amidst letting go.